everyone. Welcome to Let's Talk About It with Dora Sherry. Get ready for some lively discussion.
It's time.
It's Dora. Let's talk with Dora.
Let's talk about it.
It's Dora.
Come on, y'all, let's talk about it.
Let's talk with Dora.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Let's Talk About It. I'm your host, Dora Sherry. Tonight's guest is a woman with so much courage and a very strong voice in the movement against sex trafficking. She's also a champion for the survivors. Please help me welcome Kasha Phillips. Kasha, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yes.
How are you doing?
I'm well. Staying
still
busy.
Work?
Yeah.
Yeah. Darn those jobs, huh?
I know.
Where do you work at?
I work at Hub of Hope in Northwest Arkansas. We are a nonprofit that works directly with adult survivors of human trafficking.
Wow. Such an important thing we need, huh?
Yes.
We need
is.
More awareness, more help. I'm so thankful to you for joining us tonight and sharing a little bit of your story and why you're doing what you're doing. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your journey?
Sure. When I was 17 years old, I was trafficked for the first time. And my younger sister was also trafficked. She met a man that was 20 years older than her. And he began to groom her and take her on trips and buy her nice things. And this went on for about a 3-year grooming process. And then when she turned 18, he married her. Wow. And so that was the beginning of our experience in human trafficking. And it went on for 22 years here in Northwest Arkansas.
Wow. Yeah. 22 years. Kasha. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, what was life like for you? How old were you?
Well, the first time I ever, turned a trick, I was 17 and, it was actually a friend who had, I had been hanging out with, she was a little older than me and, she took me out that night and we were going to go to a party at the university, where we live. And, she said, well, we don't have any money to get in, but I know this man that would give you some money if you just do what he asked you. And as a young girl with a low self-esteem, and I really never felt like I belonged in any certain group growing up through school, I always just felt like I didn't belong. And, so I was a real people pleaser.
Yeah.
You know, as a child and a young girl, and I just, you know, I didn't want to lose my friends. So I ended up agreeing to it, and she took me to his house, and, you know, things happened, and I walked out just really just covered in shame after that. And that was kind of the beginning of my journey in human trafficking. And then, of course, when I connected back with my sister after she moved away, he had taken her and married her and moved her to Minneapolis and opened escort services in Minneapolis. And about a year later, she called me and was asking me to come up there because he was being very abusive to her and she was having to work all the time. And, she wanted out. So that was my intentions. When I went up to see her was to bring her home. But of course, by the time I got up there, everything had kind of calmed down. And then I saw all the nice things they had, you know, I saw the nice car. I saw, you know, he was taking her out every day shopping, a nice home. And I mean, I saw the things that, you know, growing up, the world teaches us, well, taught me that your value was based on the things that you have, the material things that you have and the money you make. And when I saw that, I wanted that too. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think so many young people are impressed by that. Yeah. They don't know what price you pay.
Right.
In the long run.
Yeah, and I didn't know the price I was going to have to pay to do that. In the beginning, it was just answering phones, setting up calls for my sister. But, you know, that wasn't a whole lot of money in that. I wanted the money she was making.
Yeah.
And so, but I didn't know what it was going to cost me. You know, her husband made it look like it was just this glamorous life that we were going to have and have all this money and do all these things. And then, of course, you know, because we grew up in a Christian home with a really amazing set of parents, even after they divorced, I still had a great parents.
Wow.
But I knew what we were doing was wrong.
Yeah.
And so that's where the kind of the drugs came into place to kind of numb that, you know, voice, or try to, you know, just take that voice away that was in my head or in my heart saying this is wrong, you know, and the drugs help that stay numb through all the things that we were going through.
So you battled addiction also then?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, one thing that we teach when we are doing awareness trainings, prevention and education for our community is when you're dealing with somebody who has been trafficked, you are not dealing with just one thing. Mm-hmm. There are so many underlying layers of issues of domestic violence, substance abuse, and then on top of it, the trafficking. So it's a lot of, and then being manipulated. And so it's a lot of trauma, multi-layered trauma that you're dealing with when somebody's being trafficked.
Mm. Did you find yourself in some pretty dangerous situations?
Oh, absolutely, all the time. Now, her husband was our first trafficker. About 5 years in, who I thought was my best friend, she opened another escort service there in our hometown and told me, you know, hey, you come over and work with me. We'll work together. You can keep your money. You won't have to pay me, you know, anything. And, you know, we did work together and make money for about a year, and then she quit working. And I kept working. And then there was, well, you need to pay. I need your money because you owe me rent. Mm. You owe me for food. You owe me for drugs. You owe me for this. You owe me for that. And so here I was back again in the same cycle, but with just a different person. Yeah.
Wow. What changed everything for you, Kasha? What was that wake up moment or that moment of change?
I call it my Damascus encounter.
Okay.
It was definitely a Saul to Paul moment for me. You know, over the period of years, while, you know, being trafficked, you know, trying to feed our addictions, I was also moving drugs, selling and buying drugs. And so in January 23rd of 2015, I was arrested on 2 delivery charges of methamphetamine.
Oh.
And I was 40 years old, but I woke up that morning before I left the house. I was at my brother-in-law's house. And just something inside me was like, something's happening today. Something in my intuition was just like, in my spirit, I could just feel it. And so I proceeded to leave the house with a friend, and we went down to a store down the street. And I don't even remember what we went for, maybe cigarettes or something. And as I was coming out of the store, the 2 detectives that had been looking for me for these drug charges just happened to be eating breakfast next door at the restaurant.
Oh, great, huh? Great time, girl.
Yeah, it was such a great time. It was just one of those divine appointments, I guess, undercover. But yeah, they saw me walk out of the store. And I got into my friend's car and we were driving back to my brother-in-law's. And before we even made it back there, they had a patrol pull us over. And they got me out of the car and they put me in the back. And they, you know, the detective was like, you know, Keisha, we've been looking for you. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, well, you know, once you bond out, if you come, you know, come talk to us, we can try to make this go away. And I just looked at him and I said, you know, I'm just really tired. I don't think I'll be doing that. I'm just tired. And I knew what they wanted me to do, but I wasn't going to, I was just tired. I didn't want to go through it anymore. And so they took me onto the jail and I slept for a couple of days in the county jail. And then the chaplain came in and she gave me a Bible. And she said, Keisha, I want you to read the red letters in this Bible because it's a love letter for you.
Oh, wow.
And I said, okay. And that night I turned to John 8. My Bible just opened to John 8. And I was looking at the red letters and when I got to verse 32 and 36, it said, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. And he who the Son sets free is free indeed. Wow. And those words just jumped out at me. And so that night I lay down and I, in the dark, and I silently just started, my heart just started crying out to God. And I said, Dad, I need you to clean up my mess. Wow. I said, I don't have anywhere else to go. I'm tired. I don't want to do this anymore. And if you are the God who you say you are, I'm going to sit here until you come get me. I'm not even going to try to get out.
Wow. Powerful.
Yeah. And 3 days later, my friend Mary, who had been trying to get me to go to church with her, showed up to visit me. And, you know, we got on the little phones and she said, God sent me to come get you. How do I get you out of here?
Wow. Wow. An angel.
Yeah. And so I just gave her a random number of a bondsman off the wall. And, you know, you normally when you, you know, use a bondsman to get out here, they come to see you, you do paperwork with them, you give them money, and then they release you. Well, I gave her a random number of a bondsman off the wall. And 20 minutes later, he called up there, told them to let me out with no money, no paperwork, nothing.
Wow. Wow, talk about God's plan. Huh?
Well, I think God knew that I needed evidence. You know, I needed that evidence that he was working for me. And of course, you know, as I was being, you know, processed out, the jailer looked at me and he said, well, that man must really trust you. And I said, I don't even know that man.
Wow.
And but I, you know, I got out and I went to his office after that. And then, of course, we did all the paperwork and things like that. And my friend Mary, she was like, well, we're leaving for my church is having a women's deliverance retreat tonight. And we want to pay for you to go. And would you go? And at that moment, I knew God had a little bit of a sense of humor because she went to an all Hispanic Pentecostal church and I don't know Spanish. I don't know much of Spanish. Yeah. But you know, like I said, you know, God needed me to see that he was all in this. So he needed to make it really look for me, this is impossible. How am I going to, you know, get delivered? I'm not even going to know what they're saying. But I'm just going to do it. I'm going to step out in faith and I'm going to do this, you know, because you've opened this door for me. And so I went, and these ladies, the pastor and his wife and all these women from the church, and I mean, they were from all over, from, you know, from Mexico, from Honduras, from Ecuador, from Guatemala. I mean, just all these Hispanic women just surrounded me. And my friend Mary was there, of course. She could translate for me a lot of it. He, you know, the pastor went through explaining what demons were, you know, how they were cast out, and gave me all these scriptures, you know, and was just teaching and teaching. And then at the end of the lesson, we just went into worship. And we just started worshiping. And in the midst of all that worship, he started telling us to start calling out the demons, calling them out. And, you know, I started calling out, you know, these demons that had attached themselves to me over the years of addiction, of prostitution, of abuse, neglect, low self-esteem, all these lies that have been, you know, embedded in me for so long. So these demons had attached themselves to me. I just started calling them out one at a time. And I was calling them out in the name of Jesus. And I just kept saying, in the name of Jesus, you have to come out. You've got to come out. And the ladies were laying hands on me and praying in Spanish over me and helping, you know. And my friend was telling me, just keep saying it, keep calling them out, keep calling them out. And I ended up like face down on the floor, and I started throwing up. I started throwing up blood. I started throwing up bile. I mean, these things were coming out of me physically too. And I could feel that where they were whole, you know, they didn't want to come out. And I just kept having to scream them out. Like, I mean, yell them, and because they didn't want to let go. And by the time it was over, I was just passed out on the floor. And I just laid there for a moment. But when I got up, I had lost my voice, like my voice had been taken. And I laid there for a little while and just soaked for, I mean, just let Holy Spirit, you know, fall on me. And once I got up, I looked out the window and I saw this bald eagle just fly across the window.
Wow.
And I heard, and it wasn't in the spirit. I mean, we were out in a place called Artist Point Skyview Cabins in Winslow, Arkansas. And it's up in the Ozark Mountains. It's the most beautiful place, but that's where we were. And so I saw that eagle fly across the window, and I heard the Lord tell me, it is finished.
Wow.
And that was it. And we went, you know, we stayed one more night. I came back just a brand new person. And he had taken the taste of everything out of my mouth. I mean, all the desires for drugs, cigarettes, everything. He had just taken it all away at once.
Wow.
And that was 11 years ago. And I have not looked back.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Not only have you not looked back, girl, but you're a powerhouse for an advocate for those who are going through it now.
Yeah.
I see you speaking everywhere. I follow you on Facebook. Everybody follows everybody on Facebook. Don't
they? I know. You know, I'm just really blessed to, you know, here in Northwest Arkansas, we just have such a tight-knit community in the recovery and, you know, nonprofit community here. It's been a real blessing. But, you know, he delivered me from all of that, but that was just the first step. You know, there was so much more that I had to deal with, you know, my trauma from the abuse and I had to divorce my husband because he just wasn't going the same way that I was going.
Oh, you were married at the time.
I was in a very dysfunctional marriage. But we were both, you know, we were both in our addiction. Okay. And when I got saved, you know, he wasn't going to leave.
Did he stay in addiction?
Yeah. In fact, he passed away. We just had his three year memorial.
Oh,
yeah. So, but you know, I was, you know, it was uncomfortable. It hurt to the pruning process after. The deliverance was great. I was, you know, feeling it, and I was filled with the Holy Spirit. And then he's like, okay, now we got to go to work. Mm. And, you know, letting people, old friends, family, you know, creating healthy boundaries, cutting people off. It was just like, oh my gosh, this is so uncomfortable. And what am I going to do? And, so I, you know, spent this last decade, you know, just being with the Lord. You know, I had my little one short-lived experience that I lost. But, you know, other than that, it's just been me and God.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had to go through the healing. I mean, I had to heal from a lot of things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Did you go through rehab or through treatment with your addiction?
I still had to deal with my consequences. That didn't go away.
Yeah.
And so they sentenced me to, I did 9 months in a program here in minimum security prison. It was more like a therapeutic community. Yeah. I did 9 months there. And then when I stepped out of that, I did drug court here. And so that was, you know, that was some intense treatment too. And I did that for a year.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Congratulations on that as a recovering opioid addict.
Yeah.
I can say, yeah, the work just starts when you make the decision, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Yeah.
Did your family know what you were doing? Did they know?
You know, we had when I first got introduced to Hub of Hope, and I, you know, kind of connected with the director, and we started doing things together, and I got on the board of directors here, and then I started doing the trainings with them. And so she had invited me to come do some trainings, and my mom came to one.
Oh.
And, and, you know, in that training at the lunchtime, we did the lunch and learn in between. And I was, you know, my boss or my, you know, the director, she interviewed me. And at the end of the interview, my mom raised her hand and stood up and, she said, I'm Keisha's mom, and I had no idea.
Wow.
She said, I had my suspicions on what was going on. I knew my daughter was in addiction. I knew that she was being abused. She said, but I didn't understand what was going on, and I didn't know how to help her.
Wow.
And my mom raised my kids. I gave my kids to her. They were at a very young age. They were 2 and 4. And I gave my mom my kids because I knew that I didn't love myself enough to, I didn't have enough love for myself to even love my children. And I couldn't keep them safe. And so in my mind, when I gave my kids to my mom, I'm going to give them to somebody who can love them, is capable of loving my kids and keeping them safe. But as my mom was a foster child and she was sent to a foster home at a very young age, and believing all her life that her mother had abandoned her and was left with her dad, who was an abusive alcoholic. In her mind, in her perspective, is how dare you choose this life over your children?
Yeah, yeah.
But she didn't understand the manipulation, the grooming, the all the things that had, and the abuse, all the control that was over us. And so, but after this training and after she heard me speak and tell my story, she said, I didn't know. And she said, I didn't know how to help her. And all I knew how to do was pray for her and then protect her kids from her.
Oh, wow. That's a hard thing to hear as a mother, isn't it?
And you know, yeah, exactly. As her daughter and as my kids, you know, being my kids' mom, you know, for a very long time, I was very resentful that my mom, the only day really throughout their lives that I was really welcome there was on my birthday. They would make a cake for me, and half the time I didn't show up.
Wow.
And, you know, those are things that, yeah, and those are things that I had to live with. But after the whole training and after she spoke and we had a conversation afterwards, and, you know, recognizing each other's perspectives and, you know, each other's hearts. And there's just a lot of healing came from that.
Oh,
that really healed my relationship with my mom and I. And I'm very grateful that she protected my kids from me, you know, now. Of course, when you're in your addiction, you're not thinking about them. You're thinking about yourself.
Yeah.
And so it was very healing. Unfortunately, my dad didn't get to see me sober. He died in 2013 from alcohol. You know, he was still, when he was alive, he was my enabler.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was his favorite. And he just kind of turned a blind eye to the things that I was doing, you know. So, but I know he's proud of me. So,
yeah.
You know, addiction just runs in our, you know, both sides of our family. And I just decided that it was going to stop with me, you know.
Wow. What's the relationship with your kids like today?
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. My son's married. He has 4 stepdaughters and 1 daughter. And my daughter still lives with my mom. She'll be 30. She'll be 30 in May. No husband, no boyfriend, no kids. And she's been at the same job. She's a daycare teacher. She's been there 11 years. She's just the sweetest. She was that child that just never got in trouble and did great things, you know, and just, you know, she loves the Lord effortlessly. And that was just, she was the one that we never had to worry about. But we had a lot, you know, my mom had a lot of help with the kids when she was a single grandma.
Wow, that's a lot of love there, isn't it?
Yeah. My mom, though, you know, even after she was a foster kid, when her and my father married, they became foster parents in the foster system and for quite a while. And then even after my parents divorced, my mom, even while raising my kids, there was a couple of kids that were friends with my youngest sister that one of them, her mom had died. And so she came and finished out high school, you know, living at my mom's house. My mom was just that, she was that one that made sure that her house was a safe space for kids.
You never know, do we? You know, we think someone that's in prostitution probably came from destitution and stuff. And
yeah,
you know, that's
not always true. It's never like respect your person.
It doesn't care who you are, how much money you make, what position you have. It doesn't care.
I mean, my mom has never struggled with any kind of addiction or anything. I mean, she was she's a registered nurse. She was a nurse at the VA hospital for 38 years. And she just raised her kids and she raised her grandkids and she's still going, you know? And so, I mean, we grew up in a, you know, a Christian home. We grew up going to church every Sunday. I mean, but my spiritual encounter with God didn't come till I was 40 years old.
Yeah. Sometimes it takes a while, you know,
yeah.
It did me too. My dad was a Baptist minister, but I didn't want to hear anything he had to say about, you know, preacher's kids. That's how.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Misha, what do you think your mom could have looked for? What are some signs that you would look for in someone, in a young person that's in sex trafficking?
You know, when we do our trainings, I talk about, you know, the identifiers and markers, you know, being in an abusive relationship. I do some for the high schools too, so because we want the high school kids to know what to look for, like with their friends, because you just never know. But, you know, if you see your child coming home with or at school with something that they can't afford, I mean, that's kind of a red flag.
Oh,
if they're coming home with a designer bag or a Chanel bag or a, you know, or something like that. And, you know, the or even their clothes that they, you know, that they just can't afford. I mean, that's a kind of an indicator that something's going on. Bruises, markings, tattoos, you know, we talk about, a lot of the traffickers like to brand their victims, like maybe a barcode on the back of their neck or a crown over their eye or a name on their wrist or their name, the man, their boyfriend's name across their chest right here. You know, there's all kinds of roses are a big one. But it doesn't mean that if they have that one tattoo, that's really what's going on. There's a lot of, or not having eye contact, looking down all the time. We served lunch at a local hotel here, you know, very prominent for trafficking and things. And we went and set up outside in front and served a meal to the people there. And there was a guy and a girl that had come downstairs, and he had her by like the small of her neck right here, you know, just his hand on her right there. Mm-hmm. And they were going through the line, and he was telling her what she could and couldn't have through the line. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my director, she was like, what, you know, asking her, you know, what would you like? And she wouldn't even look up. He was, of course, speaking for her. You know, that's another big one. Like when they start speaking for them or, you know, and then he's like, well, she can't have any of this, but I guess she can have this dessert down here. And as I left him, walked back up, he kind of lowered his hand down on the small of her back. And there was a barcode right here on her neck.
Oh, wow.
And of course, you know, you can't there. Really, what can you do?
I was just going to ask you, what do you do?
You can report it to the National Human Trafficking Hotline, but for somebody to intervene is dangerous for her.
Yeah.
Because if she's not ready to go or doesn't want to go, but somebody intervenes, he's going to take it out on her.
Yeah.
You know, regardless. And so all we can really do is report what we see. And it's just really paying attention to our surroundings and looking for those markers and identifiers. You know, when we see those people flagging people down for money on the corners, I mean, it's possible. It's possible they're being trafficked, you know, trafficking and just sex trafficking, you know, there's labor trafficking too.
Yeah.
There is, you know, and in labor trafficking, I was sex trafficked, but I was also labor trafficked. I was taken to New York to do identity theft for a trafficker that my trafficker sent me with, another one. And so it was a lot of identity theft, and I was being forced to do these things. And over the years, those are some of my charges.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but then you also have labor trafficking within the agricultural world. You have it, you know, with people who are over here illegally and they're trying to find a new life and they're, you know, trying to get some work and people take advantage of them or hold their documentation and give them a place to stay and food to eat. But that's all the pay they get. So they're never, ever getting out of that cycle. You know, there's just so many different ways that people are trafficked. And, you know, we talk about also, you know, in the court of law to prove that an adult has been trafficked, you have to prove 2 of 3 of force, fraud, and or coercion. So you have to prove 2 out of 3 of those. And with a child, you don't have to prove any. because it's a minor. But okay, with adults, it's a lot harder to prove.
Yeah. So what's one of the biggest misconceptions you would say about sex trafficking?
One of the biggest misconceptions, I think that, you know, it's definitely not. I know that we see these movies in Hollywood and we see the girl being snatched up and thrown in a van and taken away. And I'm not saying that doesn't happen, because it does. Or you see it in a third world country. Well, breaking news, 70% of the consumers for the victims, the consumers of the ones buying the buyers, 70% of those people are in the United States.
Wow.
So it's a really big misconception that it's in these third world countries and they're being sent there. No, they're being taken from there. Yeah. But they're being brought into the United States. I think that's one really big misconception. And the whole kidnapping, thrown in a van, taken, that does it happen? Yes. But what we are seeing here, and the women that we have worked with, most probably 90% of the women we have worked with here, they were groomed.
Yeah.
Like they were groomed by somebody, and it was somebody they knew.
Yeah.
Most traffickers that are trafficking somebody, they knew them before they were trafficked, because it's that building rapport, building relationship, becoming my sister and this man were friends. They were hanging out together. They were doing drugs together. They were taking trips together. He was very nice.
Yeah.
He was very nice to my mom. You know, mm-hmm. He was very, just had a great facade about him, you know. He was just he just seemed like a really nice person. I mean, I'm not saying that he was this horrible, violent person either.
Yeah.
But it was the manipulation and the control, and this is how it's going to be. And this was, and I don't, you know, one thing I do want to say though, is that after all of this happened and I came out of jail, I found out he was dying of cancer. And the Lord had me go and pray for him. And I did. And I was obedient. Wow. I prayed for him. I went there every week for several weeks to pray with him. And I just asked God to heal him, because God had forgiven me. I was full of, you know, it was, I know it was God. I know I couldn't have forgave him on my own.
Yeah.
But I went down there and that was part of that, being able to forgive him, is seeing him as a poor soul. Lost soul.
Yeah.
And so the last time I went down, the Lord really showed me that, you know, this is not how he's going to get his healing. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not going to be here much longer. And so I went down there and I, you know, I asked him, I said, you know, do you know Jesus? And he said, yeah, I do. I said, well, do you want to ask him back into your heart? And he said, yeah, I would like that.
Wow.
And so we had that prayer, and you know, he gave his heart back to Jesus, and the next day he passed away.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I just had, you know, the Lord just flooded me with such perfect peace after I walked away from there.
Mm.
Mm. It was just amazing. It was so powerful.
Healing for you, I'm sure.
It was such a freedom in that, you know. It wasn't for him, it was for me.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm just, you know, and so that, you know, the Lord showing me that, you know, even my ex-husband that passed away, you know, I was able to lead him to the Lord before he passed away too. And forgive him. It got easier every time. Yeah. Yeah, it was.
Yeah, that forgiveness is miraculous, isn't it? To forgive yourself.
It is. It's a huge miracle. Yeah. Yeah. There's not a better feeling in the world. Peace to God. And it was it saying, if you will have peace, the peace of God, if you're at peace with God.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's how I feel too.
Yeah.
So now what does Hub of Hope, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do they provide there?
So we are a hub, which means like we are a hub of resources. We don't have safe housing yet.
Yeah.
But we are community funded. We just got our first federal grant, and it was for a housing grant to be able to put up to 4 women into, you know, get them moved into their own place. But we don't have a safe house or anything like that. But what I do is I do their case management. I, you know, walk alongside these girls, help them find the resources they need, whether it be sober living, transitional living, or, you know, low income housing, wherever we can get them. And then just create a plan, like, you know, a strategy, a plan for their life, meeting their needs, whether it be food insecurity, or they need to get their IDs, they need to get their driver's license, they need to get to the doctor, or they, you know, all those things, safe transports, I do all the time. But we also, what HOPE stands for is healing and opportunities for survivors of trafficking, and prevention and education for our community. So we do a lot of that. We do a lot of trainings for our community, for law enforcement, for the schools, for social workers, nurses. We do all that prevention and education for the, but we have over 585 nonprofits just in Northwest Arkansas.
Wow.
So there's always somewhere, somehow, whatever somebody needs, you know, there's usually gets met. I mean, it's not real difficult. I mean, housing is a little, you know, hard, but we've been able to really help. But my job recently has taken a turn, a little bit. I mean, a little bit of different things going on. So we go into the detention centers, the jails, county jails here. And I've been going into Benton County Jail, and we go in and do a presentation on human trafficking to the girls. And after our presentation, we have them all sign a piece of paper. And if they want to, you know, if they want to further connect with us, we, you know, we have them put a little star or something next to their name. And then I will reach out to them through jail mail. And then I will go in and make an appointment or a visit with them and do an assessment to see if, you know, because usually after the presentation, there's always several that say, oh, I think that happened to me and I didn't even know it. And so I'll go in there, do an assessment, do some paperwork. What we are finding now, though, is last November, I had a particular client that was in the jail, and she was in there for drug trafficking charges. And I did her assessment, and I was like, oh, yeah, this girl's been trafficked. And I was like, but something just doesn't feel right or doesn't look right. And so I started digging, and I looked up her case, and I went to my attorney friend, and I was like, you know, I need you to look at this with me. I need an extra set of eyes, you know? And so we looked at it together, and he's like, this is forced criminality. So she has been forced to sell drugs for her trafficker along with him selling her. And there's a name for it now called forced criminality. They didn't have that when I was doing my thing. So we were able to prove that it was forced criminality with her assessment, her statement, and all the investigation. You know, we put a report together. He helped me do that. Then we sent it to her public defender. He took it to the prosecutor. And we got her charges dropped from drug trafficking charges to a simple possession charge and probation.
Wow.
So, and it was just going in every week, talking to her, building that relationship, because really our goal is, I mean, that is our thing. We like building relationships. That is really our main goal and through all of this, you know. And bringing them to a point of thriving or being a voice for themselves. I can be a voice for them for a while, but I want them to be able to become a voice for themselves and for the next person. That's kind of the goal. But yeah, this turn, it was like, well, I love being within the justice system. I am a huge advocate for people with injustices. I mean, that's my thing. And I thought I was never going to be able to be an attorney. And, you know, I failed at all that stuff, you know, because of my lifestyle. But I was like, oh my goodness, I'm going to get this door open anyway.
Wow.
And so I just started meeting with people. I started meeting with the public defender, started meeting with our new prosecutor, our old prosecutor. And so I was like, well, we're just not going to stop here. So I got with my attorney friend who is big in anti-trafficking around the world and does a lot of trainings for law enforcement around the world. And he's in mostly cyber stuff, but he knows a lot of people. And so he's like, we need to put a training together. I said, yeah, we do. I said, we need to put one together for the prosecutor's office, the public defender's office, the judges, and the law enforcement, and do it all at once on this forced criminality. We can just stop it before it starts so they don't have to be, you know. And the most wonderful thing about all of this is that I have already worked with 4 women on this same issue.
Wow.
And they were bravely enough. They turned over their trafficker too.
Wow. That does take bravery.
That doesn't happen.
They hold you with that fear of them.
Yes.
They instill that.
They did it.
Wow. So you helped change their lives and give them their lives back.
Yeah. I wanted them to just take their life back. Take power, take control over your life. You know, I mean, it's okay. Those are just words and thoughts of fear that these people, you know, and I'm not saying it always ends up like this, but just that first one, I was like, to my boss, I was like, well, I know it's a small win. She's like, what?
No, it's not a huge win. Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And I was like, well, you know, I think God has like spiritual peripheral blinders on me. Like I don't really see that what I'm doing is a big thing. I mean, it's God doing it through me, but I'm like, oh, okay. You know, da, da, da. And then they're like, what? And I'm like, it's just what I do. And I love doing it. It's what I do. I just love it. It's where my heart is.
If you had gone a different path, you wouldn't be doing this today, would you?
No. And I always tell everybody, they're like, when I say, well, I was trafficked for 22 years, they're like, oh, you're kidding. You know, I'm like, no, it's okay. Like, I love where I'm at today, and I would never have gotten there if I didn't go through it. Yeah. You know, and I wouldn't be out here being able to relate to these girls or become friends with these girls and build a safe community for them, you know, if it hadn't happened.
Yeah.
You know, and it's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing. Yeah.
Well, when you talk to them, they know that you know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Addiction.
They know that they can't pull nothing over me. Either,
yeah.
So. Some of them don't like that, but you know, they get over it. It's okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, they know it's for their good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's for sure. Yeah. I'm so proud of you.
Oh, what thank a you long, so much.
What a way you've come. Long way you've come, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
To say the least.
I had help. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're helping a lot of people too, Keisha. And I pronounced your name wrong earlier. I said, Gotcha, that's the hillbilly.
You know what, Dora? Let me tell you something. I have been called way worse in my lifetime.
Oh, yeah, girl, me too.
That's what I tell everybody. It's okay. Even the doctor, when I'm at the doctor, the nurse will come out and she'll look at my name and look up at me. And they'll say, Miss Phillips.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
And when they do try, they're like, I'm so sorry. I said, it's all right. It's all right.
Yeah. No sometimes worries. It's the simplest names. I tell people my name's Dora Sherry and they go, how do you spell that?
Yeah.
It throws them off.
Yeah.
Oh, Kesha, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story tonight and coming on with us and giving us some a picture of what that is like and you know, the importance of raising the awareness to it and helping those and instead of judging them and punishing them.
Well, thank you. You thank know? You for having me.
Oh, my gosh. You're a delight. You'll have
well,
to come.
Well, I am so glad we were able to finally meet because, you know, got a lot in common.
Yeah. That's important. Yeah. Well, we had a very special friend. I didn't know if you wanted to talk to about him or not.
Oh, we can. Yeah.
Mr. Absolutely. James Clay.
That's right. That's right.
Model yes. tested.
Man. Yeah. That was, you know, that little short-lived experience. But it blessed me in so many ways.
Yeah.
And all the plans that he had, you know, I was able to pass those, all the plans that he told me about that he had for his nonprofit. I had, you know, he had sent them to me in an email and I printed all those things out. And, you know, after he passed on Christmas Eve, I had a couple that were getting ready to open a transitional living down in South Arkansas. And they called me Christmas Eve and asked me to come have coffee with them. And they said, the Lord told us that you had something for us.
Wow.
And I had his plans in a notebook in the back of my car.
Wow.
And I, the Lord told me to go get them. And you know that they used those plans and they now have their third house.
That's amazing.
In South Arkansas, bringing men out of incarceration. And they're being successful. And so his plans were never wasted. And I'm sure they're working somewhere else too, you know.
Oh, yeah. But, and I'm sure he's smiling right now looking at us going, well, I had no idea.
Yeah,
you
I know, right?
Your team up.
Yep. Yeah, he keep passing that torch.
And I miss him a lot. He was a good friend, a good man.
Yeah, he was.
So,
yeah.
But he brought us together, didn't he?
He did. Divine appointments.
Yeah, good things happen sometimes out of bad situations.
Absolutely. He always works everything for his good and his glory. So,
he sure does. Well, beautiful lady, thank you so much.
All right.
And we'll be seeing you again soon and keeping up with what else you're doing.
Okay, sounds good.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Blessings to you, Keisha.
You
thank
too.
You.